The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening. This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Well, it's Wednesday. Welcome to it. Nicole Sandler here at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network. And yesterday was primary day in Texas, the official launch of the 2018 midterm primary season. It's off and running. And despite some of the hype that you may have heard, Texas did not turn blue overnight, but it's moving in the right direction. There were more Republicans who voted than there were Democrats, but there was some interesting news. Before we move on to other matters, a bit about what happened in Texas yesterday. The DCCC's hit job on progressive Laura Moser appears to have backfired. She placed second in the gang of Democrats running for the nomination. So she did qualify for the runoff that happens, I believe, May 22nd. So she against, and I don't have the name of the woman, the person who finished first, but Laura Moser is in the running for this, for the nomination in Texas 7th District. Now, Howie Klein tweeted something out earlier that he heard from, and we'll get him to talk about this tomorrow, Howie Klein, of course, always here on Thursdays. Let me see if I can't find his tweet quickly. No, I didn't save it. Oh, I hate when I do that. I always think that I saved something, and then it turns out that I didn't. Let me see. Oh, here it is. He wrote, DCCC never learns. After inadvertently handing her a place in the runoff, a staffer there just told me they are going to go nuclear on Laura Moser and make her unelectable. That will hand Culberson, the Republican incumbent, re-election on a silver platter. The only way to stop them is to defeat Pelosi. So there's Howie Klein weighing in on Twitter on, you know, about what happened in Texas 7th District. In other places in Texas, let's see, our friend Derek Crowe unfortunately placed third in a very crowded primary Democratic race, so he did not make the runoff in the 21st District. I don't know much about the two candidates who are in the runoff, but Derek Crowe is out of the race. But, you know, good for him for running. He really should have won because he was a fantastic candidate. A progressive Gina Ortiz-Jones will go on the runoff on the 23rd District, and Veronica Escobar won her primary outright in the 16th. I believe, and I could be wrong, but I believe the 16th is where Beto O'Rourke is from. Beto O'Rourke, of course, giving up his House seat to run for the Senate to challenge Ted Cruz, and that will be the face-off in November, Beto O'Rourke against Ted Cruz. So if you're in Texas, help Beto O'Rourke. He's awesome. And our friend Dana Steele won her primary in the 36th District. There was only one other candidate, and Dana handily defeated her. So Dana Steele is going to go up against a popular hard right incumbent. And nobody thinks she has much of a chance of winning. But again, good for her for running. So that's what happened in Texas. The next primary, if my reading is correct, is in Illinois, I believe, on March 20th. So that's happening. Down here in Parkland, Florida, I'm in Coral Springs, the next town over, both Betsy DeVos and Dwayne Wade appeared at Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School today. Apparently, Wade's visit was much, much warmer more warmly received than DeVos's, who did not win over many students, I'm told. The Florida House is in session. The Florida legislature is still in session for a few more days. And after the Senate passed its Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School Public Safety Act on Monday, the House took up the bill yesterday, and they spent all day debating it. The House Democrats presented more than 30 amendments to the bill, which all failed. The bill includes, now here, it's an interesting bill. It imposes a three-day waiting period on the purchase of all firearms. It boosts the minimum age to buy a gun to 21, and it bans the sale of bump stocks. So those things are good, right? But here's the rub, as they say. It also allocates roughly $400 million for a host of initiatives, including hardening schools and funding mental health assistance. It also includes a $67 million for a controversial school marshal program that would allow school employees to carry concealed weapons on campuses after completing 132 hours of training under the auspices of the Sheriff's Department. But there are more limitations on it. The only teachers who could participate in the program would be those in the JROTC program, a current member of the U.S. Reserves or National Guard, and current or former law enforcement officers. Other school staff could also volunteer for the program, but all other classroom teachers would be blocked from it. This from the Palm Beach Post. They say the proposed Guardian program, first adopted by the Senate on Monday, is a major change from the initial draft of the bill, which would have allowed any teacher undergoing training to carry firearms. The initial version sparked uproar from Douglas High survivors and parents and opposition from the governor, leading to the Senate scaling back the program on Monday. That still wasn't enough for the House Democrats, though, yesterday. So we'll see what happens. Representative, Florida House member Jared Moskowitz of Coral Springs, my town, who's a Douglas High School alumni, proposed an amendment to get the Marshall program out of the bill and replace it with one that used retired law enforcement officers in schools. But that went down as well. Rick Scott, the governor, won't say if he'll sign this bill or will he say if the House, who is debating it now, should pass it or not. So stay tuned. Yesterday, the state of Oregon became the first state to actually pass any gun legislation in the wake of the Parkland, Florida shootings. So that's the latest on all this. I've got more news coming up for you in just a moment. And what's news? I just want to let you know that today on the program, we're going to talk a bit about depression because it is it's affecting so many of us more than you might imagine, and more so since Trump was elected president. But the causes of depression are different than what we've been told, so says my guest on the program today, Johan Hari, who you've likely seen on Real Time with Bill Maher and maybe heard on this show over the years. I think the first time I interviewed Johan Hari, who's a journalist and an author, was back in the Air America days, so it's been a while. Anyway, let's take a time out for news, for what's news, and we'll come back with Johan Hari next. I read the news
today, oh boy. It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
More turmoil in the West Wing as Gary Cohn, Trump's senior economic advisor, resigns. CNN has the report.
Another day of chaos as the president's top economic advisor, Gary Cohn, is resigning. He is leaving the White House, apparently, according to our sources talking to us here at CNN, apparently upset about President Trump's plans to slap tariffs even on some U.S. Trading partners and allies. The president talked about this potential for a trade war earlier today. Here's what some of what the president had to say.
And one of the reasons I was elected is I'm protecting our workers, I'm protecting our companies, and I'm not going to let that happen. So we're doing tariffs on steel. We cannot lose our steel industry. It's a fraction of what it once was, and we can't lose our aluminum industry. You know, when we're behind on every single country, trade wars aren't so bad.
Now, ever since the president announced the plan for these tariffs last week, Gary Cohn has been working behind the scenes to try to change the president's mind. He has been working essentially alongside other top Republicans on Capitol Hill, like House Speaker Paul Ryan, who have been essentially pleading with the president to change his mind on all of this.
At a press conference with Sweden's prime minister on Tuesday, Trump was asked about staffing changes and if he wants to replace Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
That you would like to see some change in the people around you. Does that include your Attorney General Jeff Sessions or either of your cabinet secretaries?
No, I don't really talk about that. I just said that the White House has tremendous energy. It has tremendous spirit. It is a great place to be working. Many, many people want every single job. You know, I read where, maybe people don't want to work for Trump. But believe me, everybody wants to work in the White House.
Sure.
They all want a piece of that Oval Office. They want a piece of the West Wing. And not only in terms of it looks great on their resume, it's just a great place to work. It's got tremendous energy. It's tough. I like conflict. I like having two people with different points of view, and I certainly have that. And then I make a decision. But I like watching it. I like seeing it. And I think it's the best way to go. I like different points of view. But the White House has a tremendous energy, and we have tremendous talent. Yeah, there'll be people. I'm not going to be specific, but there'll be people that change. They always change. Sometimes they want to go out and do something else, but they all want to be in the White House. So many people want to come in. I have a choice of anybody. I could take any position in the White House, and I'll have a choice of the 10 top people having to do with that position. Everybody wants to be there. And they love this White House because we have energy like rarely before.
And he took credit for North Korea's seeming about-face on their willingness to open talks.
Do you believe that North Korea's recent willingness to talk is sincere, or is it an effort to buy time for their nuclear program? And to what do you owe this recent openness to talk?
Me? No. I think that nobody got that.
Amazing. In a story that would be much bigger news in any other administration, Stephanie Clifford, also known as Stormy Daniels, an adult film star who claims she had an affair with Donald Trump, is now suing the president.
Porn star Stormy Daniels suing President Trump, seeking to invalidate the nondisclosure agreement she signed just days before the 2016 election, preventing her from talking about their alleged sexual encounter. The lawsuit argues the agreement is null and void because it was not signed by Mr. Trump. Daniels' lawyer says Mr. Trump purposely did not sign the agreement so he could later, if need be, publicly disavow any knowledge of the contract and Daniels. According to the complaint, Daniels had an intimate relationship with Mr. Trump that began in the summer of 2006 and continued well into 2007. The adult film star and director, whose real name is Stephanie Clifford, considered sharing her story in 2016 after the Access Hollywood tape surfaced. The complaint alleges Trump's longtime attorney, Michael Cohen, intervened, paying Daniels $130,000. Daniels says Mr. Trump knew about the payment, which she calls hush money. Last week, Cohen admitted to paying Daniels, but insisted that neither the Trump Organization nor the Trump campaign was party to the transaction with Ms. Clifford, and neither reimbursed me for the payment, either directly or indirectly. The lawsuit says Cohen has continued to intimidate Ms. Clifford into silence and shut her up in order to protect Mr. Trump, even as recently as February 27th, when Cohen filed a bogus arbitration against Daniels without giving her notice of the proceeding and basic due process. In the lawsuit, Daniels also alleges Cohen coerced her into signing this statement in January, which states that reports of her relationship with Mr. Trump were false. Now, there are lots of details, of course, in this lawsuit, one of which is pretty stark and pretty telling. It says that if she or he breaks the agreement, that there is a $1 million penalty for each breach of the agreement. That would explain a lot as to why neither person would be talking. But now it's all laid out in that lawsuit. And what's important here, I think we need to mention, is that if the allegations are true, this is definitely a violation of the federal election laws.
Only in America. I got the news. And that's a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener funded, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate.
You're listening to The Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
All right, we're back. Today we're going to take a slightly different turn than what we usually do. Well, you know what? Let's just get right into it. I've made no secret of the fact that I suffer from depression. And so when I found out that one of my favorite authors, Johan Hari, who's been a guest on this program before, had a new book coming out about depression, I thought this is going to be interesting. And sure enough, it was. So Johan Hari is a New York Times bestselling author and journalist whose new book is Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions. Johan, it's so good to talk with you again. It's as we said, it's been about 3 years or so. And you've
I'm always happy to talk with you. I think we've been doing interviews for years and years now, haven't we? I think the first time we spoke was, 10 years ago or something.
It could have been. Well, and you've been busy. I want to jump right into this book and why you decided to write a book about depression.
You know, there were these two mysteries that were hanging over me, Nicole, and I was quite frightened to look into them. The first is, I am 39 years old, and every single year I have been alive, depression and anxiety have increased in the United States. I wanted to understand why, what's going on. And I wanted to understand it for a very personal reason, which was the kind of other mystery for me, which is when I was a teenager, I had gone to my doctor and I'd explained that I had this feeling like pain was leaking out of me and I couldn't control it or regulate it. I felt very embarrassed by it. And my doctor told me a story. He said, well, we know why people feel this way. There's a chemical called serotonin in people's brains. It makes them feel good. Some people are naturally lacking it. You're clearly one of them. We'll give you these drugs. You'll feel better. And I started taking the drugs and I felt an immediate and huge boost for a few months. But then this feeling of pain started to kind of bleed back through. So I went back. He said, clearly, I didn't give you a high enough dose. He gave me a higher dose. Again, I felt better. Again, the pain came back. And I was in that cycle until I was taking the maximum possible dose for 13 years, at the end of which I was still depressed. And I want to know, well, I'm doing everything I'm told here, and I still feel really bad. What's going on? So I ended up, for my book, Lost Connections, I ended up going on this huge, long journey. I ended up going over 40,000 miles. I went to meet the leading experts in the world on what causes depression and anxiety and what solves them. And I went to places that just have really different perspectives on this, from an Amish village in Indiana, because the Amish have really low levels of depression. I wanted to understand why, to a city in Brazil that banned advertising to see if that made people feel better, to a lab in Baltimore where they're giving people psychedelic drugs to see if that made them feel better. And I think I learned many things, but I think the biggest thing I learned is until I went to my doctor when I was a teenager, I thought my depression was all in my head, meaning I was just being weak, I needed to man up. And then the next 13 years, I thought my depression was all in my head, meaning it was just a chemical imbalance in my brain. But one of the biggest things I learned is, of course, there are real biological factors that can make your depression worse that I write about, but largely the causes of depression and anxiety are not in our heads. They're largely in the way we're living. I write about these 9 causes of depression and anxiety for which I learned there are strong scientific evidence. Only 2 of them are biological. 7 of them are in the way we live. And once you understand that, it opens up a very different path out of depression.
It's different when you're a teenager and then when you're an adult. But many of us, in fact, my battle with depression started when I was an adolescent as well. Do you find different at different times in your life, it's different factors that influence how depressed you are or what manifests itself into depression and anxiety?
Yeah. So I learned there are these 9 causes of depression and anxiety. And they play out. Some depressed people, of course, most depressed people won't experience all of those 9 causes at any point in their life. But one of the things that kind of connects them, and I think does connect teenage and adult depression, although there are real differences, as you say, is everyone listening to this show knows that you have natural physical needs, right? You need food, you need water, you need shelter, you need clean air. If I took them away from you, you would be in real trouble real fast. There's equally strong evidence that human beings have natural psychological needs. You need to feel you belong. You need to feel your life has meaning and purpose. You need to feel that people see you and value you. You need to feel you've got a future that makes sense. And our culture is good at lots of things. I'm glad to be alive today. But we've been getting less and less good at meeting these deep underlying psychological causes for huge numbers of people. And that's one of the biggest reasons why we have this rising crisis in depression, anxiety, and addiction. And I learned that there are lots of people who are pioneering different approaches for how we respond to that, which I think should be regarded as antidepressants. Anything that reduces depression and anxiety should be regarded as an antidepressant. That should include chemical antidepressants, but it needs to be a much wider menu. And the most effective kinds of antidepressant are actually the ones that deal with the reasons why we feel so bad in the first place.
On your website, thelostconnections.com, you have some questions and answers, like a little quiz. How much do you know about depression? And you say that the serotonin story that you were told by your doctor when you were a teenager, that's not true, even though it's what we're being told still to this day.
This really shocked me. And this is one of the most painful things I learned for Lost Connections, because when you've got a story about your pain, even when that story doesn't work very well, it kind of, how would I put it? It kind of structures your pain. It gives you, at least you feel you know where you are, right? It's like putting a leash on a wild animal. Mm-hmm. And the process of changing my story was very difficult for me. It felt like for a moment I was letting this wild animal off the leash. But as you say, this doesn't mean that chemical antidepressants have no value. They have some value. But yeah, it was really shocking to me to learn, you know, Professor Andrew Scull at Princeton University, is one of the leading experts on this, says the idea that depression is just caused by low serotonin is deeply misleading and unscientific. It's kind of shocking to me. One of the leading experts in Britain, Dr. David Healy, explained to me when I went to see him, you can't even say that story has been discredited, because there's never a time when it was credited. There was never a time when half of the scientists in the field would have said it. It was effectively a story that the reason that story was sold to us is because it was good PR for the drug companies, right? It makes it sound like it's just a chemical imbalance, and therefore what the drugs do is restore you to a natural balance. That's not true. It was very shocking to me to learn this. It's important to say we have to have a nuanced conversation. Just because depression is not caused by a chemical imbalance, there are of course biological things going on as well, but they're mostly factors in our lives that are causing this crisis. It's important to say it doesn't mean the drugs have no value, but it means we have to have a more realistic conversation about what they do. I thought I was really weird and unusual for taking chemical antidepressants and getting a bit of a boost, but still being really quite depressed. I discovered actually the science shows I was completely normal, right? My experience was quite typical. Depression is often measured by something called the Hamilton scale, right? Mm-hmm. I've always felt sorry for whoever Hamilton was, that we only remember him by measuring how miserable we are. But the Hamilton scale goes from 1, where you would be, you know, dancing around in joy, to 51, where you would be acutely suicidal. To give people a sense of what movement on the Hamilton scale looks like, if you improve your sleep patterns, you'll gain 6 points on the Hamilton scale. If they get worse, like when you have a baby, you'll generally lose 6 points on the Hamilton scale. On average, chemical antidepressants, according to the leading expert at Harvard Medical School, move people 1.8 points on the Hamilton scale. It's important to say that's an average, so I initially got more than that. Over time, I got less. It's important to say that has real value, right? If you're acutely suicidal, for example, that could be the thing that saves you. But it's not solving the problem for most people. This is why most of the studies that look at antidepressants, chemical antidepressants, are short-term studies. So they look at the effect in the first few months, which is really quite significant. It certainly was for me. But the long-term studies suggest that for most people, they don't solve the problem, right? So they're giving a bit of a boost. They're giving 1.8 points on average. They're not solving the problem. But one of the people who really helped me to think differently about this and to think about how I could recover from depression and how other people could, I went to interview this South African psychiatrist called Derek Summerfield, who happened to be in Cambodia in 2001 when chemical antidepressants were first introduced there. And the local doctors didn't know what they were. So he explained. And they said, oh, we don't need them. We already got antidepressants. And he said, what do you mean? He thought they were going to talk about some kind of herbal remedy or something. Instead, they told him a story. There was a farmer in their community who one day had stood on a landmine left over by the American invasion of Southeast Asia and got his leg blown off. And they gave him an artificial limb and he went back to work in the fields. But apparently it's super painful to work underwater when you've got an artificial limb. I imagine it's obviously traumatic for him. He started to cry all day, didn't want to get out of bed, classic depression. And so they said to Derek, we gave him an antidepressant. He said, what was it? They explained that they went and sat with him. They listened to him. They saw that his pain wasn't some, you know, irrational spasm. His pain made sense. They figured if they bought him a cow, he could become a dairy farmer. He wouldn't be in this position where he'd be being so traumatized and in such physical pain. They bought him a cow. Within a few weeks, his depression went away. He was back to having a happy life. They said to Derek, so that cow, that was an antidepressant. That's what you mean, right? Now, what those if you've been raised to think about depression the way we have, that it's just a spontaneous problem in the brain, that sounds like a bad joke, right? I went to my doctor for an antidepressant. He gave me a cow. But what those Cambodian doctors knew intuitively is what the leading medical body in the world, the World Health Organization, has been trying to tell us for years. If you're depressed, if you're anxious, you're not crazy. You're not a machine with broken parts. You're a human being with unmet needs, and you need support and practical love and encouragement and practical changes in your life, helped by other people, that will get you out of the situation that's not meeting your deeper needs. Now, that's a very different way of thinking about what an antidepressant is, but I then learned, I go through in the books, you know, I saw this everywhere I went, from San Francisco to Sydney to Sao Paulo. The most effective strategies for dealing with depression and anxiety are ones that deal with the reasons why we feel this way, some of which are very deep in our culture. And so I started asking myself, well, what's the cow for us, right? What's the cow for the problems we're facing that are causing us depression? And I think I found some of the answers.
So you're saying that depression, while part of it could be chemical imbalance, part of it definitely could have to do with genetics. Most often it's situational. It's the circumstances in which we find ourselves, the way we're living our lives, that are the root cause of the depression?
So I'll give you an example of one of the causes, because I think if you talk about it in an abstract way, it can sound a bit strange. Mm-hmm. So the United States today is the loneliest society that has ever been. There's a study that asks Americans, how many close friends do you have who you could call on in a crisis? And when they started doing it years ago, the most common answer was 5. Today, the most common answer is none. Wow. Right? It's not the average, it's the most common answer. And someone who taught me a lot about this is a man who sadly, actually, I just found out died yesterday, wonderful man called Professor John Cacioppo at Chicago University, who was the leading expert in the world on the science of loneliness. He discovered, so when we're acutely lonely, when we're stressed in any way, we're flooded with a hormone called cortisol. Professor Cacioppo showed that if you are acutely lonely, that is as stressful as being punched in the face by a stranger. And explain to me why. You think about the circumstances where human beings evolved. We evolved in, the reason why you and I are alive, Nicole, and able to have this conversation through our shiny screens, is because our ancestors on the savannas of Africa were really good at one thing. They weren't stronger than the animals they took down. They weren't bigger than the animals they took down. They were much better at banding together into tribes and cooperating. Every instinct human beings have is to be together as a tribe. Bees need a hive. Humans need a tribe. And if you think about those circumstances where we evolved, if you were separated from the tribe, if you were alone or lonely, you were anxious and depressed for a really good reason. You were about to die, right? You were in terrible danger. Those are the impulses we still have. So I was interested in looking at, given there's been this enormous rise in loneliness, what can we do about that? And given that Professor Cacioppo had proven this is one of the big causes of depression, and there's a doctor who's one of the heroes of my book, Lost Connections, who's really shown, he did an extraordinary experiment that has been followed by other people across the world now to try to deal with this. So Sam Everington is a doctor in a very poor part of London, where I'm from, as you can tell from my weird Downton Abbey accent. Uh-huh. And Sam was really uncomfortable because he was a general practitioner. Loads of people were coming to him with depression and anxiety. And like me, Sam's not opposed to chemical antidepressants, but he could see it just wasn't solving the problem for most of them, right? And one of the things that was going on is they were really lonely. So he decided to try something different. A woman came to him who I got to know well called Lisa Cunningham. And Lisa had been shut away in her home with terrible depression and anxiety for 7 years. And Sam said to Lisa, don't worry, I'm going to carry on giving you these drugs, but I'm also going to try something different. I'm going to prescribe for you to take part in a group. There was an area of kind of like scrubland behind the doctor's surgery. He said, what I'd like you to do, I'll turn out and support you, is I'd like you to come twice a week, and with a group of other depressed and anxious people, we're going to turn this scrubland into a beautiful garden. The first meeting, Lisa was literally physically sick with anxiety. She barely left her house in 7 years. But several things happened. The people in the group had something to talk about that wasn't how terrible they felt, right? They began to learn gardening. They started to put their fingers in the soil. They started to read about gardening. They started to learn the rhythms of the seasons. There's a lot of evidence that interacting with the natural world is an incredibly powerful antidepressant. They also did what human beings do when we get together in groups. They started to solve each other's problems, right? Humans do that when we care about each other and we know each other. And the way Lisa put it to me, as the garden began to bloom, we began to bloom. There was a similar program in Norway that was studied very carefully, found that it was more than twice as effective as chemical antidepressants. I think for kind of obvious reason, right? It was dealing with the reasons why people were so depressed and anxious in the first place. Two of the reasons, their disconnection from each other and their disconnection from the natural world. Now, there are, of course, seven other causes of depression and anxiety that I write about. But to me, that program is an antidepressant, right? It's reducing people's depression, but it's doing it in a different way to just drugging them, although, of course, drugs should remain on the menu.
The book is called Lost Connections. We're speaking with Johan Hari. And in fact, you do list disconnection, the 9 causes of depression and anxiety, and they're all various forms of disconnection from meaningful work, from other people, from meaningful values. So it's this separation quality, this disconnect from things that are meaningful in our lives that you say are the causes of depression and anxiety.
Yeah, one of the ones that really struck me, and it took me a while to think this through and what the implications of the research were, is I noticed that lots of the people I know who are depressed and anxious, their depression and anxiety focuses around their work. Mm-hmm. So start to look at what's the evidence for how people feel about their work, and the figures are pretty shocking. Gallup, the opinion poll company, did the best research we have on this, took years. They found 13% of us, 13%, like our jobs most of the time. 63% of people are what they called sleepwalking through their work. They don't like it, they don't hate it. And 24% of people hate their jobs and fear them, right? So that's quite striking. 87% of people don't like the thing they're doing most of the time, right? And almost twice as many people hate their jobs as love them. I started to think, well, could that, given that's what we do most of the time, most of our waking lives, could that be having some effect on our mental health? So I discovered it and went to meet an amazing Australian social scientist called Professor Michael Marmot, who had discovered in the 1970s, I can explain how if you want, but I'll just give you the headline, the core of what causes depression at work. So what Professor Marmot found is, if you go to work tomorrow and you are controlled, so you have low or no autonomy, you are significantly more likely to become depressed, or actually significantly more likely to die of a heart attack. And I think this is related to what we were saying before. Human beings have psychological needs. And one of them is to feel that what we're doing is meaningful. And if you're controlled all the time, you can't create meaning out of your work. And I started thinking, well, what's the solution to this, right? I actually misunderstood what Professor Marmot was saying. At first, I thought he was saying, okay, you've got this elite 13% who get to have nice jobs, and they're going to be happy and content, but everyone else is going to be miserable. And then I was like, well, what about, you know, my dad is a bus driver, my brother is a delivery guy, my sister's a nurse, right? Are we just saying they're going to be condemned to be depressed? And he said to me, no, Johan, you don't understand. It's not the work that makes you depressed. It's being controlled at work. And there's a way we can fix that. A lot of people can't fix it as individuals, but we can fix it as a society. So I went to Baltimore, met an amazing person called Meredith Keough. So Meredith used to go to bed every Sunday night just sick with anxiety, right? She had an office job. Wasn't the worst office job in the world. She wasn't being harassed. She wasn't being bullied. But it was monotonous, and she couldn't bear the thought this was going to be the next 40 years of her life. So one day with her husband, Josh, Meredith did this quite bold thing. Josh had worked in bike stores in Baltimore since he was a kid. And, you know, it's pretty insecure, you know, controlled work, as you can imagine. And one day, Josh and his colleagues had just said, what does our boss actually do? They didn't hate their boss. He was an okay guy. But they thought, well, we seem to fix all the bikes and he seems to make all the money here. They decided to set up a bike store that would work on a different principle. So it's not a corporation with a boss at the top controlling everyone below. It's a democratic cooperative. So the way it works is they take all the big decisions about the business together by voting. They share out the good tasks and the less good tasks, so no one gets stuck with the less good tasks. And they, and of course, they share the profits. And one of the things that was so fascinating going and speaking to them, their store is called Baltimore Bicycle Works, very successful, was how many of them, completely in line with Professor Marmot's research, explained how they used to feel depressed and anxious in this controlled way of working, but they don't feel depressed and anxious now. Now, it's important to say, it's not like they quit their jobs fixing bikes and they went off to become, you know, Beyonce's backing singers, right? They fixed bikes before they fixed bikes now. But the difference is they've got control over their work now. And that's the thing that's driving the depression and the anxiety, the control. Now, as Josh put it to me, there's no reason why any business should be run as a top-down corporation that's making people depressed, right? This is a very recent human invention, the modern corporation. Every business could be a democratic corporate. Think about how many people you know, Nicole, who are, you know, depressed and anxious or just unhappy, who would feel quite different if they knew that tomorrow they were going into a workplace where they got to set the priorities with their colleagues, where if there's a boss, he's elected by them and accountable to them rather than just the other way around, where, you know, where they could use their creativity at work, where the good tasks and the less good tasks got shared out fairly. That's a very different way of living. And I think the evidence is that it would significantly reduce depression and anxiety.
I think you're right. Absolutely. There are other parts, though. There are other things that can cause depression and anxiety. I see a therapist regularly. I've as I mentioned to you off the air, I've suffered from depression since adolescence. I, too, have struggled with antidepressants that don't seem to, you know, they may make a little difference, but certainly have not made me well. Whatever well might be. But we have a new phenomenon that I think is affecting certainly people here in the States, if not in other parts of the world. I'm sure it has seeped around. And it's been in effect for, about 13 months now. And that is, we have this president in the White House that inspires disgust and fear and terror and all kinds of unsettling emotions in us. There's been a marked, and in fact, my therapist even said that they've seen more people come in since Trump was elected president with new symptoms of depression. That's not something that's internal. That's not something that we can change. How do we overcome that kind of anxiety and depression?
Yeah, I think this is a really deep question, which I was really thrilled that my book is the first book since the election that Hillary Clinton has endorsed. She was really nice about it, although I'm more a kind of Bernie person.
Me too.
But I was really moved that she did that. And actually, a really interesting range of people have engaged with the book in that way. I think there's an even deeper thing related to Trump and these things we're talking about, which is, if you live in a culture where people's psychological needs are not met, where they are profoundly distressed, and then they're told their distress is just the result of something being broken in their brain, I think that leads to all sorts of terrible problems. I had this moment in the run-up to the election that really has stayed with me, and I think is related to the thing you're asking about very closely. I was I was with a wonderful group from the Los Angeles LGBT Center, who I'm writing about for a different book. And we're trying to get out the vote in West Cleveland, in a very devastated part of West Cleveland called Slavic City. And we're on one of those streets. It's like Detroit without the poetry of the ruins. You know, it's like a third of the houses have been abandoned, a third have been demolished, and a third still have people living in them, often behind actual barbed wire. And we knocked on this one door. And there was a woman who I would have thought, from looking at her, was 60. I discovered she mentioned when we were talking that she was the same age as me. I was 37 at the time.
Wow.
I was quite taken aback. And she was very intelligent. She was very articulate. She knew quite a lot. She was incredibly angry. She actually wasn't a Trump supporter. She was saying she wouldn't vote for anyone because she hated them all. And while she was talking, she made this mistake. She talked about how when her parents and grandparents were there, that they left school when they were 16 and they had, you know, good secure employment. And she meant to say when I was young. What she actually said is when I was alive. And it really knocked me back, because I thought, this is how a lot of people feel in the United States and across the Western world, right? If you live in a culture where people are told, you know, where they are acutely lonely, where they're told that life is about money and status, and there's lots of evidence, the more you think life is about money and status, the more unhappy you'll be, where you are, and this woman had no money and status, obviously, where you are, you know, where you're told that life is about screaming at people through screens, where you're constantly financially insecure, that's going to be a society with a very deep depression and anxiety crisis. And for perfectly good reason, all that pain makes sense, right? And if we don't deal with those deep underlying reasons why people, why our culture is not meeting people's needs, we're going to get more and more candidates who are going to just say, burn the house down, and there's going to be more people for whom that message resonates. And I understood why this woman, you know, I begged this woman to, although I was not, as you know, a great Hillary fan, I thought she was radically better than Trump, as I think has been borne out by everything that's happened in the past year. Mm-hmm. You know, I begged this woman to vote for Hillary, and she just said, look at my street. Look at us, right? And I could understand totally where she was coming from. And that is such a deep crisis in the culture. And, you know, there's an Indian philosopher called Krishnamurti who said, it's no sign of good health to be well-adjusted to a sick society. And I've thought about this a lot since the rise of Trump. And actually, I wrote one of the very few articles that said I thought he was going to win, partly for these reasons, well ahead of the election. You know, all the alarm bells are going off, right? The 1 in 4 middle-aged women is taking an antidepressant in the United States at any given time. 1 in 5 Americans will take a psychiatric drug in their lifetime. Mm. 1 in 10 teenage boys, 13-year-old boys, is being given a very powerful stimulant drug to make them focus. I mean, we're talking about a staggering range of symptoms of a deep underlying crisis. And to just pretend these are superficial problems that need a little bit of a tweak, so maybe, you know, if the Russians hadn't done this thing, or, and of course they did, and of course it was terrible, and, you know, and it did play a role, or maybe if we just chemically tweaked another million people, you know, it'll all be okay. And I think that's a really mistaken way of thinking. And I think we need to look at places in the world that have experimented with different approaches. So I'll give you one example of a very concrete, I don't want to make people depressed, ironically. You know, I'll give you an example of a really interesting antidepressant that was tried that I think begins to deal with, it's not, of course, the solution, there is no one solution, but I think it's a really interesting thing to look at. In Canada in the 1970s, the government did this really interesting thing. They chose a town at random in Canada. It was a place called Dauphin. It's in Manitoba. And they said to a load of people in this town, because they had a welfare state, but, you know, a lot of people were still poor. A lot of people were still very insecure and unhappy. Said to a load of people in this town, from now on, we're going to give you a guaranteed basic income. That means we're going to give you the equivalent of $15,000 in today's money. We're going to give it to you in monthly installments. You don't have to do anything in return for it. And there is nothing you can do that means we'll take this away from you. We just want you to have a good life. And this was monitored. They did it for 3 years, and then a conservative government came in and got rid of it. And they monitored it to see what happened. And loads of interesting things happened. People spent more time with their kids. Virtually nobody stopped working, but lots of people quit crummy jobs and held out for better jobs. So it meant work standards overall improved. More people studied. But to me, the most interesting thing is there was a huge fall in mental health problems. Mental health problems that were so severe people had to be hospitalized fell by 9% in just 3 years.
Wow.
Extraordinary. You won't find a drug that causes that amount of fall in hospitalization, right? And I think, again, and the woman who amazing academic who studied this in great detail, Dr. Evelyn Forget, said to me, that's an antidepressant, right? You know, and again, there'll be lots of people listening to your show, Nicole, who, you know, more than half of Americans, because of the tremendous financial pressure they've been put under, have not been able to set aside $500 for if a crisis comes along.
Right.
Think that. And so a lot of people listening to this are going to be really depressed and anxious as a result of that. Don't let anyone tell you that that's the result of a chemical imbalance in your brain, right? The chief doctor at the United Nations, the Special Rapporteur on Health is his full title, said in an amazing statement last year for World Health Day, we need to talk a lot less about chemical imbalances and a lot more about power imbalances if we're going to deal with depression and anxiety. He's absolutely right. There's this bizarre thing where we kind of depoliticized the distress that is caused by the crazy political direction we've gone in. We need to change that. If we don't change that, we're going to see a lot more frightening candidates and a lot more extreme options, and it's going to take more than just Oprah running for president to fix that one. Right? We've got to, not that I'm dissing Oprah, because no sane person would do that, but do you see what I mean, Nicole?
I do entirely. You talk about, reconnecting. Maybe one way to reconnect with other people is to get involved politically, because this is something that's bringing us all together in our own isolation, perhaps, if that makes sense.
I went to, the struggle is the solution, right? Coming together to fight for something in itself is an incredibly powerful antidepressant. And if you don't mind me, have I got a few minutes to tell you a story? Because it's the most profound story I learned for the book.
Absolutely.
And a lot of the things I learned for the book, I learned intellectually from interviewing the leading experts, but there were key places where it fell into line with me, where it fell into kind of emotional place for me. And there's one place in particular. So in the summer of 2011, on a big anonymous housing project in Berlin, a woman called Nuria Cengiz put a sign in her window. So she lived on the ground floor of this huge housing project. Picture a big housing project in Baltimore, you've basically got it. The sign said something like, "I got notice that next Thursday I'm being evicted from my apartment, so on Wednesday night I'm going to kill myself." No one really knew her on this housing project, but people start walking past. Now, this is a slightly weird area. It was a very poor part of Berlin. So the only people who lived there were recent Muslim immigrants. Nuria had been there about 30 years. Gay people and squatters like punks. And as you can imagine, these three groups looked at each other with a lot of kind of mutual incomprehension. People started to knock on Nuria's door and said, "Do you want any help?" She said, "No, screw you. I don't want any help. I'm going to kill myself. Shut the door." Loads of people in this housing project were angry because their rents had been rising too. Rents had been rising very rapidly in that neighborhood as it gentrified. And lots of people were being evicted. And one day, you might remember, this was the summer of the revolution in Egypt. Occupy Wall Street was about to happen. Mm. And one day, one of the people who worked there just had this idea. There's a big thoroughfare that goes through this housing project in this neighborhood, Kotti, that runs into the center of Berlin. And they said, "You know what? If we just blocked the street, we blocked the road for a day, and we wheeled Nuria out and we protested, I bet the media would come, we'd get a little bit of coverage, they'd probably let her stay in her apartment." So they did it. Nuria was like, "Well, I'm going to kill myself anyway. I may as well let them wheel me out here." And the media did come, and she does her interviews, a bit bemused, but she does her interviews. And then at the end of the day, the police say, "Okay, you've had your fun. Take it down." But the people there said, "Well, no, you haven't told Nuria that she gets to stay here. And actually, we want a guarantee that our rents are going to be frozen." There was a woman, one of my favorite people at Kotti, she's called Tanya Gartner, who's a punk. She wears a tiny miniskirt, even in Berlin winters, which shows real dedication. And she had in her apartment one of those things you take to soccer matches that make a really loud noise. So she went and got it from her apartment. She said, "Okay, what we're going to do, we're going to draw up a timetable to man this barricade. And if the police come to take it down, let off this klaxon and we'll all come down and stop them." So people start signing up to man this barricade, right? People who've never met each other, don't know each other. And you start getting these really weird pairings. So Nuria, very conservative religious Muslim in a wheelchair, was paired with Tanya, who's a mini-skirted punk with a huge number of tattoos. They were given the night shift. I think it was Tuesday nights they got. And the first few times they sat there, that is super awkward. They think, "I've got nothing in common." But they started to talk to each other. They discovered they, in fact, had this incredibly similar thing happen to them. Nuria had come to Berlin when she was 17 years old from her village in Turkey with her two children. Her job was to raise enough money to send back for her husband, who stayed in their village in Turkey. After she'd been in Berlin for a year and a half, she got word that her husband had died. She told Tanya something she'd never told anyone. She'd always said to people that he'd died of a heart attack. He actually died of tuberculosis, which was seen as a disease of poverty. She'd been really ashamed of that. Tanya told Nuria this story. She'd been thrown out by her family when she was 15. She'd come to Kotti. She ended up living in a squat. She got pregnant. They realized they'd both been on their own with young children in this place they didn't understand. They realized how similar they were. All over Kotti, there were these pairings of incredibly unlikely people who were getting to know each other and realizing how much they had in common. Opposite this housing project, there's a gay club called Zudblock, and it's run by a guy I love called Rick Hardstein. And to give you a sense of what Ricard is like, the previous club he owned was called Cafe Anal, right? So, you know, they're pretty uncompromising guys. Uh-huh. And when they'd opened this club, you know, as you can imagine, there's a big Muslim population there. They'd been really angry. Actually, some of them had smashed the windows. And the gay club started to say to the protest, you know, they gave all their furniture to the protest. They said, you guys can have your meetings here in our club, if you like. And at first, even the kind of lefties at Cotty were like, look, we're not going to get these religious Muslims to come and have meetings in a gay club. But actually, they did. They came to the meetings. As one of the protesters said to me, Uli, everyone took these steps, right? Everyone took steps that they wouldn't otherwise have taken. One day, a guy turned up at the protest called Tunkai. Tunkai is... He was in his early 50s at the time, and he's clearly got kind of cognitive difficulties. But he's lovely. He'd been living homeless. He's lovely. Everyone liked him. And by then they had turned this barricade into a permanent structure blocking the road. And they were like, look, you can sleep here if you want. We all like you. So he started sleeping there, and he became one of the things that really united the whole protest movement. All the groups, the Muslims, the gays and the punks, all loved Tunkai. And one day, after he'd been there about 6 months, the police came. They were inspecting. They did that every now and then. And Tunkai doesn't like it when people argue. He thought the police were arguing. So he went to hug one of the police officers, and they thought he was attacking them, so they arrested him. That was when it was discovered that Tunkai had been shut away in a psychiatric hospital for 20 years, and he'd only escaped shortly before he found his way to Koti. So they took Tunkai back to this psychiatric hospital, and the whole camp, the whole of Koti, just turned into this Free Tunkai movement, right? So they descend on this psychiatric hospital at the other end of Berlin. And these psychiatrists are completely bemused that there's all these Muslim women in hijabs, these gay people, these punks saying, we want him back, right? I remember Uli saying, one of the protests saying, you know, to these psychiatrists, he belongs with us. We love him. He doesn't belong here. And it made me think about how few of us, if someone took us away, would have hundreds of people descending saying, no, this person belongs with us. Anyway, mm-hmm. They got Tunkai back. He lives there now. Many things happened at Koti. The biggest headline is they got a rent freeze for their entire housing project. They then launched a referendum initiative to get one for the whole city. And they got the largest number of written signatures in the history of the city of Berlin. But when I went to see Nuria, the woman who'd started this whole protest with that sign in her window, the last time I saw Nuria, I remember she said to me, you know, I'm really glad I got to stay in my neighborhood. I gained so much more than that. I was surrounded all along by these amazing people and I never knew. And I remember another one of the women, Turkish German women there, Neriman, said to me, she'd grown up in a village in Turkey. And when she'd grown up in that village, she'd learned that she called home her whole village, right? That was what you called home. And she came to the West and she learned that what you're meant to call home is just your four walls. Mm-hmm. And then this whole protest began. She got to know everyone and she thought of the whole of Koti as her home again. And she said to me that she realized that in some sense she had been homeless the whole time she'd been living in the West, right? That we're, in some sense, we are homeless. Our sense, we need to feel we belong, and our sense of home is not big enough to meet that sense of belonging. There's a wonderful Bosnian writer called Alexander Heyman who said, home is where people notice when you're not there. And I realized how acutely lonely and homeless we are in our culture, many of us, and how it's just below the surface, this different way of being. It didn't take much for those people at Koti to be really moved by what was happening, and it struck me how powerfully they didn't need to be drugged. They needed to be together, right? The problems that seem insoluble when you are alone and you are broken up and you are fragmented become soluble when we are united and we are together, right? Nuria was suicidal. Tunkai was shut away in a literal padded cell. There were loads of people at Koti who had really deep problems. When they had a group, a tribe of people watching out for them, those problems could be solved. They couldn't be solved when they were isolated and alone. Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. And it seems like these came together very organically, that, or at least that gathering did. In the case of the garden, it was a healthcare professional who put these people together. One of the problems we have here in the States is we don't have doctors prescribing groups of people to go and transform a dog shit alley into a garden. I guess that's what we have to figure out on our own.
I think part of what's going on is, you know, there's a $10 billion industry to be made in drugging, the $10 billion industry in drugging people just with antidepressants alone. And there's a $0 industry in getting people to go gardening in a group and getting to know each other and creating a beautiful garden. Right? I mean, presume it's not $0 because people buy the gardening products, but it's not very much, right? And part of what we have had is this distortion as a culture where only the causes and solutions that can be monetized are the ones that get researched, right? So it's important to say those causes are not false and the solutions that are produced by that machinery are not worthless, right? There are very real biological contributions to depression and anxiety that I write about in my book, Lost Connections. They are very real. For example, your genes can make you significantly more sensitive to these other causes of depression and anxiety. They don't, on their own, the genes don't cause it, but they make you much more sensitive to it. We all know that with weight. Like, I only have to eat one Snickers bar and I put on weight. Mm-hmm. I have friends who I despise who, you know, can eat 10 Big Macs and don't put on weight. So, you know, I'm more genetically sensitive to putting on weight, and some people are more genetically sensitive to depression. But equally, if I don't eat the Snickers bar, I'm not going to put on the weight, right? So there are real biological factors, but you're absolutely right that because we live in this hyper-capitalist culture, we end up with this bizarre distortion of what's going on, where all we're told about in most cases is the biological causes. Sometimes you're told a little bit about psychological causes like childhood trauma, which are also very real, and I write about in the book as well. For example, really, the research about how interacting with the natural world is a really powerful antidepressant. There's lots of interesting evidence about this. I'll give you one example. There's a prison in Michigan, the state prison in Michigan, that just by coincidence wasn't designed this way. One part of it looks out over beautiful green fields and trees and lush greenery, and another part looks out over just concrete. It was a big study that showed the people who looked out over the greenery, the prisoners who looked out of the greenery, that was random where you ended up in the prison, were 23% less likely to become depressed and anxious, right? Mm-hmm. I talked in the book to Dr. Isabel Benke. She's one of the leading experts on this. She's an amazing Chilean expert. And she talks about how, you know, in zoos, animals go crazy, right? Parrots rip out their feathers. Horses will start obsessively swaying. Elephants will grind their tusks down to a bloody stump, even though they're their pride and joy in the wild. You know, when animals are deprived of their habitat, they go crazy. We as a species are increasingly deprived of our habitat, right? This is one of the 9 causes of depression and anxiety that I write about in the book. Again, exposure to nature, there's not a lot of money to be made out of that, but it happens to be an incredibly powerful antidepressant. But there's very little research, and you will not, you know, unless you've got a really forward-thinking doctor, it's unlikely people are told about that. Because it's not monetizable, therefore there's, you know, it's not promoted to doctors. It's not a criticism of the doctors themselves. As a society, we've only given doctors one lever to pull, right? And they're confronted with genuinely depressed people, and, you know, the lever gives some of the people relief, so I don't blame them for pulling it. But we need to have a much, much wider menu of options for depressed and anxious people than we currently do.
And the menu is found in the book. It's Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions by Johann Hari. Lots of great information as well on the website at thelostconnections.com, including interviews with some of the people you interviewed for this book. And there's exhaustive research done for this book. Johann Hari, it's so great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Nicole, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And I should just say, can my publishers tell me off if I don't say this, that on the website, people can also find out what a big range of people have said about the book, from Glenn Greenwald to Naomi Klein to Russell Brand, mm-hmm. to Hillary Clinton, and even, this is a really weird experience we can talk about another time, Tucker Carlson, the Fox News host, which is really unexpected. it was not, as you can imagine, that's not my politics. But yeah, I was pleased that one thing that can unite us as Americans and citizens of the Western world is our misery.
So we've got plenty of it to go around, sadly.
Great. Well, it's such a joy to talk to you, Nicole. Thank you so much.
You as well. Thank you. Really appreciate it. Johann Hari, again, the book is called Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions. All those great stories that he told are in the book and then some. It's definitely worth a read, and it'll give you a new perspective on something that so many of us battle on a daily basis. So there you go. Just one more way of coping. I don't know. Not ready to give up the pills yet. Tomorrow is Thursday. That means Howie Klein will be here. We'll do a postmortem on Texas and look ahead to Illinois and what comes beyond. Thank you, as always, for listening. I'm Nicole Sandler at NicoleSandler.com and on the Progressive Voices Network.